blame on anyone, but to avoid future miscalculation. And the major questions would have been, where was Carrie? Why was there no warning? Why was a gunner's mate making the critical life-and-death decision instead of the officer in charge? Why the many different accounts by Carrie? Carrie avoided any problem by filing an after-action report in which the dead child simply disappeared from the record and was replaced by a fleeing squad of Viet Cong, some likely killed by Carrie. A terrible human tragedy was converted by another Carrie lie into another sterling triumph by the young war hero. According to Gardner, Carrie threatened to court-martial those involved, even though the crew believed they had seen weapons on the sampan. Gardner strongly believes that the sight of potential weapons justified the firing. When writing their biography of Carrie, the Boston Globe reporters note that pro-Carrie supporters have tried to discredit Gardner and dismiss his criticism of Carrie. In March 2004, Gardner was quoted publicly for the first time about his views on Carrie in the Boston Globe and on Time magazine's website. But in the Time article, written by Douglas Brinkley, Carrie was quoted as reacting strongly to Gardner's criticism of him, saying that Gardner had made up stories. Brinkley dismissed Gardner, a supporter of President Bush, as being motivated by one word, politics. Carrie said he couldn't remember the court-martial threat. Gardner denied the allegation that politics had anything to do with his comments. "Absolutely not," he said, saying that he has kept his feelings about Carrie to himself for 35 years and responded only when a Globe reporter tracked him down. Division Commander George Elliott never knew of the small child's death because all he received from Carrie was the false report, which found its way up the chain of command. The Commander Coastal Surveillance Force Vietnam, CTF-115, Quarterly Evaluation Report of March 29, 1969, states, 20 January, PCFs 21 and 44 operating in An Duyen Province, engaged the enemy with a resultant GDA of 1 VC KIA. BC, body count, 4 VC KIA, killed in action, estimated, and 2 VC CIA, VQ-810650/44. This is Carrie's victory, killing 5 imaginary Viet Cong, capturing 2 Viet Cong in action, an exaggeration of the mother and baby who were actually rescued from the sampan, and simply omitting the dead child. It typified Carrie's victories in Vietnam, those of a master with a pen and paper and of gaming a system of naval reporting built on trust. Admiral Hoffman, receiving Carrie's false report of probably killing 5 Viet Cong and capturing 2 others, sent him a congratulatory message. Upon learning of what Carrie had actually done, Hoffman recently expressed his contempt for Carrie as a liar, false warrior, and fraud. Despite Carrie's written report, rumors of the incident circulated for years. The vivid memory of the small, bloody sampan haunts Silver Star winner Bill Frank, a veteran of many battles. A boat officer of Coastal Division 11, and one of the real heroes of the incident portrayed in Carrie's No Man Left Behind video, Jack Chenoweth, has recently written that the only atrocity I ever knew of or heard about was Carrie killing the small child in the junk. In Tour of Duty, Carrie, according to one of his own accounts, appears to have lost control of his boat after crazily ordering that warning shots be fired at a small sampan with heavy 50-caliber weapons, instead of the numerous small-caliber weapons on board. According to the biography written by the Boston Globe reporters, Carrie simply butchers a small sampan in a free-fire zone because it would have been dangerous to approach. The crews on the boats of Coastal Division 11, like law enforcement officers in the United States approaching a stopped car on a darkened highway, faced potential danger. Yet thousands of sampans were approached and boarded by Coastal Division 11 sailors without causing the deaths of civilians, despite the fact that a great number of these sampans were encountered in the dark of night in free fire zones. A free fire zone was not an order to fire, but was discretion to fire first if threatened by or when confronting enemy forces. There was always an apprehension of danger in approaching a junk or a sampan in the dark. But none of the Swifties, so far as is known, would ever open fire because of fear that a satchel might be thrown. If Gardner's account is wrong, and the above Carey version is correct, it would have been simply butchery to open fire on a small sampan merely because it was in a free fire zone. Numerous Coastal Division 11 Swifties recalled the Kwa Lone River sampan debacle with true distaste for Carey, remembering him as someone who lied and who pushed the envelope of accepted conduct. Many Swifties believed that Carey was reckless with human life when the lives in question were Vietnamese. A statement from Swiftboat Officer Bill Frank makes this point. The Vietnamese were, pursuant to martial laws enacted by the South Vietnamese government, not permitted to transit up the waterways from dusk until dawn. Under the rules of engagement, if a swift boat encountered such a boat underway during this prohibited time, and if that boat sought to flee, it was permissible to fire upon that boat. In virtually every instance, such a boat was simply returning late from fishing. Fishing was the means of survival for most of the Vietnamese. Absent clear indications of danger, swift boat crews simply did not open fire upon such boats. Rather, the vessel would be boarded, searched, and let go with a warning. Often the crew would notch the boat with a K-bar knife along the starboard gunwales just aft of the bow. If a boat with several such notches was stopped, the officer in charge might go so far as to fire a round from an M16 into the hull, causing a leak that could be readily plugged, but sending a message to the crew. Carey chose not to honor this code. Rather, when encountering a fishing boat returning up the river to a nearby village, Carey's boat opened fire on the vessel. Whether one believes in Carey's or Gardner's version, Carey's boat was ultimately responsible. The fishing vessel could not possibly escape, given the vast disparity in speed between sampans and swift boats. Frank writes, "A swift boat carries 3 50-caliber machine guns, 2 M60 machine guns, and various other armaments. When, for example, the twin 50-caliber guns in the gun tub are discharged, it is a vicious, savage act. 1,100 rounds per minute scream into the darkness for up to a mile, destroying anything in their path. No officer who honored this code would unleash such a savage attack upon a defenseless family absent clear and present danger." Tom Wright, another PCF commander, gave serious reflection to the way Carey chose to interpret free fire zones. "We believed that free fire zones placed the greatest responsibility on the ONC, because he alone had to decide if he was going to shoot. In the other areas, the ROE, rules of engagement, told you what to do. John Carey thought that free fire meant kill anyone you see. Not every person is a good combat commander. John Carey was not a good combat commander. In free fire zones, you had to always consider your unit's safety and then the overall picture. Fire discipline was important. Your reputation was important. You wanted the enemy to see you as a competent, effective force that dominated his location. Shooting at someone just because you saw them was a mistake. We were trying to gain control over an area. To achieve that, we had to control the people in an area. I felt that being able to apprehend, question, and release a person in a free fire zone was a major victory. The more we could communicate with the people, the more we could control their actions. We wanted them to accept us and our authority. It was necessary to shoot in the free fire zones from time to time, and the circumstances normally fell within the normal ROE. Occasionally, at night or in poor visibility, we might shoot a little quicker than the rules would have allowed, or engage a target based on secondary information. I always knew that I was responsible for the safety of my men and our actions. Working in a free fire zone made me feel more responsible, not less. Wright had such difficulty working with Carey that he finally objected to going on patrol with him. John Carey's leadership and operational style were different from mine. I can see how his crew thought he was a hero, but it seemed like he was a hero fighting out of situations he shouldn't have been in to begin with. I had a lot of trouble getting him to follow orders. Most specifically, I believed that overall responsibility rested squarely on the shoulders of the OTC-ONC in a free fire zone. You had to be right, and you had to have fire discipline. You couldn't blame something on the rules of engagement. I had some very serious problems with Carey one day, and I told the Div Comm that I did not want Carey in my group anymore. No discussion of this incident can be found on Carey's campaign website, nor is there any official document among those Navy service records that Carey has made public. Steve Gardner's testimony and the CTF-115 quarterly report both indicate that Carey's boat picked up the woman and her baby who survived in the debacle, whom Carey's after-action report described as captured Viet Cong. Yet no record indicates what became of the woman or the child when Carey's boat returned to shore. The squad of four Viet Cong fleeing to shore that existed only in Carey's imagination and in his written report does not exist in Tour, or in Carey's statements to Cranish, or in Carey's secret journal, or in any recollection of anyone. Carey's victory exists only in Carey's mind. Nonetheless, he succeeded in pulling off this fraud until the recent record comparison. Animal slaughter. George Bates, an officer in Coastal Division 11, participated in numerous operations with Carey from January 1969 through March 1969. In Bates' view, Carey was a coward who overreacted with deadly force to protect himself when he felt threatened. Bates, a retired Navy captain, believed that Carey treated the South Vietnamese in an almost criminal manner. Bates is haunted by a particular patrol with Carey on the Song Bo Day River in the first part of 1969. With Carey in the lead, the boats approached a small hamlet with 3 to 4 grass huts. Pigs and chickens were milling around peacefully. As the boats drew closer, the villagers fled. There were no political symbols or flags in evidence in the tiny village. It was obvious to Bates that existing policies, decency and good sense, required the boats to simply move on. Instead, Carey beached his boat directly in the small settlement. Upon his command, the numerous small animals were slaughtered by heavy-caliber machine guns. Acting more like a pirate than a naval officer, Carey disembarked and ran around with a Zippo lighter, burning up the entire hamlet. Bates has never forgotten Carey's actions and was appalled by the complete hypocrisy of Carey's quick shift to the role of a peace activist condemning war crimes upon his return. Even today, Bates describes Carey as a man without a conscience. Fabricated protests against war crimes. In contrast to his highly questionable activities in combat and on patrol, Carey invented an elaborate persona in his journal, and the years after his tour, in which he repeatedly protested to his superiors against possible war crimes at great risk to his career. Take, for example, Carey's discussion of a meeting on January 22, 1969, in which Admiral Elmo Zumwalt addressed the swiftboat commanders of Coastal Divisions 11 and 13. Carey's journal reflects questions that he supposedly asked, critical of Operation Sea Lord. This event is reprised in Tour of Duty. I asked how, if our job was ostensibly interdiction of the movement of supplies, they could justify offensive actions such as we had been sent on, attempts to draw the enemy into ambush and then destroy his ambush capability. He said that the purpose was to show the American flag, an answer that seemed very strange to me when I considered it was the Vietnamese flag that we were supposed to be fighting for. Why didn't we show their flag? Or better yet, let them run up the rivers and show their flag. Many friends of mine in the Marines told me about their operational orders and necessity for artillery wherever they go. The Admiral went on to say that he knew Navy men found it hard to go out and find the enemy, but that the Army did it all the time, and that we should get used to it. I wanted to point out that the Army was equipped and trained differently than us, and that they had some form of support beyond that which we had. But then I thought better of it, and silence was the better part of valor. After some parrying, the Admiral was finally rescued by his trusty aide, Captain Roy Hoffman, who stood up and made a few remarks about the unavoidability of innocent people being killed in Southeast Asia. Zumwalt declared this normal, fortunes of war, as it were, and to be expected. Roy Hoffman notes that Carey's version of the meeting on January 22, 1969, was just another Carey-concocted lie. Hoffman states, "I was standing behind General Abrams and Admiral Zumwalt, observing the audience reaction. I distinctly remember Carey sitting separated several seats from the nearest associate and to the left of the speakers. He did not ask one question or otherwise participate in the dialogue." The confrontation as imagined and reported by Carey is typically self-serving, designed to advance the idea that he was an outspoken critic of military policy, willing to challenge his superiors whenever possible. Most of those in Coastal Divisions 11 and 13 remember Carey as deferential to superiors. During the television debate with John O'Neill on the Dick Cavett Show, Carey related to O'Neill and the world the threats of mutiny in which he supposedly participated while in the military. "We were fighting the free fire policy very, very hard, to the point that many of the members were refusing to carry out orders on some of their missions, to the point where crews were starting to mutiny, to say, 'I would not go back in the rivers again.'" The Boston Globe reporters reject Carey's assertion, however, in their report of the debate. "None of the swiftboat sailors and officers who served with Carey and were interviewed said they could recall a mutinous threat, nor did Carey's subsequent actions suggest he was gun-shy." From the entry in his journal in 1969 to his gross exaggeration on the Dick Cavett Show and in numerous speeches up to and including the publication of his campaign biography in 2004, John Carey has lied. There never was any documented instance of a mutiny in Coastal Division 11 or 13. The Swifties carried out their appointed missions as ordered, pure and simple. Commander George Elliott, Carey's direct commanding officer at An Toi, who stood up for Carey in 1996 when he was accused of a war crime during a press conference, labels Carey's mutiny and war protest complete fabrications, as do more than 20 other officers and sailors. Tour of Duty repeats another falsified story in Carey's journal, this time involving Carey and Donald Droz, a swiftboat hero killed in 1969, a month after Carey left Vietnam. Supposedly, Carey confronted Coast Guard Captain Adrian Lonsdale with a speech worthy of John Wayne. But the swift skippers pressed Lonsdale to fight harder for the support their missions needed. Carey opted to implore him for a policy change one last time. "Sir, all we need is to give the men a little more of a chance," he began. "They're willing to fight because they're here, and that's what they have to do, but they want to fight with some prospects of getting somewhere. Why can't we have some helos that are waiting, always on the ready for us, so that when we get fired on first, if we must, we can at least expect some support and hope to get some of the enemy and make them actually worry about what we are doing? That way, we might be able to catch some of them or get some weapons or something. We could at least have a reason for going in there. Lonsdale, according to Carrie, did not answer the question. Instead, he gave a variety of excuses to the effect that he was worried about his job and that he had no choice but to do what Hoffman wanted done with regard to Operation Sea Lord. Once again, like the Dick Cavett Show mutiny story and the fictionalized speech at the Operation Sea Lord meeting, the speech Carey supposedly delivered to Lonsdale is also a complete fabrication, delivered only in Carey's imagination and recalled by neither Lonsdale nor Hoffman. None of the many superior officers who dealt with Carey on a daily or weekly basis can ever remember him giving any such speeches. In Carey's journal entries, his moral principles were foremost, and he was determined to speak out to those misguided authorities above him. In reality, Carey was critical, grumbling, and anti-war when he talked with his peers, but deferential when addressing his superiors. The only speaking out Carey did to his superiors was in his mind or the pages of his private journal. Carey could not recall any personal atrocities in which his unit was involved when he appeared on the Dick Cavett Show. By 2004, however, his memory had improved remarkably. In Tour of Duty, Brinkley writes, "Carey would never forget how ardently Captain Hoffman lauded the exploits of one enterprising officer from the Da Nang Swift Division. The officer had surprised some 30 Vietnamese who were fishing in round floating baskets just off the shore of a peninsula in an area that was, unfortunately for them, a free fire zone. Hoffman considered it ideal military thinking that the Swift skipper had shown the presence of mind to sneak his boat in between the baskets and the shore, cutting the fishermen off from escape, and then opening fire on them. All the baskets were sunk, and so were the fishermen. Fantastic," Hoffman reportedly proclaimed upon hearing the news. Carey himself would later hear Hoffman praise such industriousness at a remarkable meeting in Saigon. Clearly, the Navy had undergone a sea change. Not only were cowboy antics on the rivers of Vietnam no longer frowned upon, they were rewarded with medals. "I was in country after this happened," Wade Sanders later wrote. "When the ONCs heard about this and heard that the butcher was being considered for a Silver Star, a howl or outcry was heard all the way to Kamran Bay, and Captain Hoffman reversed the consideration of a medal. We all thought the son of a bitch should have been court-martialed." Wade Sanders, however, is a political friend of Carey's, who never served in Da Nang and was not in Vietnam at the time of the supposed incident. Sanders did receive a political appointment in the Clinton administration, with Carey's help, and was a contributor to Carey's now discredited 1971 book, The New Soldier. Although Sanders does not here repeat the unsubstantiated allegations of war crimes made in the book. So Sanders, while never having seen the incident and never having any military service in Da Nang, states that although he was in country only after the incident happened, he nonetheless recalls hearing about it. So Carey relies upon the hearsay testimony of Wade Sanders, a longtime political operative in his debt, to support his claim. This story is wholly denied by Admiral Hoffman, who never worked on any medal recommendations in Vietnam except one, the Medal of Honor that later went to Democratic Senator Robert Carey of Nebraska, a genuine hero. It was simply not Hoffman's job to award medals. In addition, numerous division commanders and Swifties deny knowing anything about the purported incident. Moreover, neither Carey nor Sanders, who were not officers in charge in Da Nang, ever observed or spoke to Hoffman about the incident. The division commanders and many sailors strongly denied the basket story, and it is certain that there is neither a record nor any other known account of such an event. Since the officer in charge is not identified, nor are any details such as date, boats, or personnel provided, it is not possible to comment further on the alleged incident. So it is uncertain whether Carey simply took an actual incident and distorted it to such a degree that it could no longer be recognized, or whether the incident was simply invented. In 2003, the telephone rang at Admiral Roy Hoffman's residence. It was John Carey, calling shortly before his announcement that he was running for president. Hoffman, who is now 78 years old and who has survived sunken boats in both Korea and Vietnam and more hostile fire than nearly anyone among us, thought at first that the call was from Robert Carey, not John Carey. Hoffman, like most Swifties, had never imagined that anyone would take John Carey seriously as a contender for President of the United States. So for the first 4 or 5 minutes, Hoffman responded enthusiastically, eager, as most Swifties would be, to assist Robert Carey in his bid for the nation's highest office. Then, when Hoffman realized he was speaking with John Carey, not Robert Carey, his tone changed almost immediately, and he became completely noncommittal. Once he declined to give Carey his support, the conversation faded fast. On March 15, 2004, Admiral Hoffman's telephone rang again. Once again, the caller was John Carey. Carey had clinched the Democratic nomination, and he knew that Hoffman was organizing Swifties to bring out the truth about him, his exaggerated military record, and his anti-war lies that had slandered his fellow veterans. Carey made the admiral an offer. If you will back off and drop your efforts, I will ensure that my biography, Tour of Duty, which I know is unfair to you, will be changed to make it accurate in a revised edition. Here is my secretary's number. You can get me any time. The offer from the Democratic presidential candidate was an attempt to flatter Hoffman, a warrior whose coin is not power or wealth, but honor, an honor deeply impugned by Carey's book. Hoffman, after all, is a wounded survivor of the amphibious assault at Wonsan, Korea, where his minesweeper still lies below the frigid waters of Wonsan Harbor. Carey knew that winning Hoffman over to his side would thwart the Swifties' efforts to discredit him. Hoffman told Carey that he and the vast majority of his shipmates could never forgive him for his defamation of our Navy and other U.S. armed forces by his slanderous and undocumented accusations of unspeakable atrocities in Vietnam before the U.S. Congress in 1971. His leadership in the VVAW and his association with the traitorous Jane Fonda and others of her ilk. Surprisingly, Carey responded by simply saying that he was expressing his conviction. If Admiral Hoffman were truly a butcher, whose conduct sickens John Carey to this day, an impression one could easily gain from reading Tour of Duty, then why did he call Hoffman to seek his support? Why would Carey offer to change inaccuracies he knew were in Tour of Duty in exchange for Admiral Hoffman and the Swifties ceasing their activities? In emails on May 3, 2004 and on May 7, 2004, trying to dissuade Swifties from joining Admiral Hoffman, Wade Sanders referred to the group as bitter drunks, something the sailors involved deeply resented. Moreover, Sanders referred to Joe Ponder, a seriously disabled Swiftie who cried when talking about Carey's charges, as a whining crybaby. Why does it matter now that Carey converted his own record from that of a ruthless, self-promoting liar hungry for medals and fame into that of an anti-war activist jeopardizing his career by protesting in imaginary conversations with superiors? Why does it even matter if he continues to do so today? It matters to the Swifties because Carey has libeled distinguished commanders such as Admiral Zumwalt and their fellow sailors, living and dead. More important, it matters deeply to the future of hundreds of thousands of servicemen and a nation that depends on its commander-in-chief for loyalty, support, stability, direction, and genuine care. Chapter 5. More Fraudulent Medals. Put me on the list. I was standing next to one of my crew at Seafloat when he was killed in a sapper attack on the USS Krishna, Lanny Buroff, July 1970. He was awarded the Navy Commendation Medal, posthumously. No silver or bronze star like Carey got for filling out forms. David Borden, PCF 40, April 28, 2004, email. As corpsman with the Marines, Gulf 2-5, 1967-68, I agree totally with the information you are trying to get out on Carey. Three Purple Hearts, Silver Star, Bronze Star, in such a short tour is amazing. You will see Gulf 2-5 was involved. In the battle for Hue City, complete with block-to-block, house-to-house, and sometimes room-to-room fighting. Throughout that battle and many others after that, I never saw anyone win so many decorations in such a short time. Actually, by the accounts I have read on the Silver Star, I would have punished him. Corpsman John Doc Higgins, U.S. Marines, Gulf 2-5. When John Carey got his third Purple Heart, we told him to leave. We knew how the system worked, and we didn't want him in Coast Div 11. Carey didn't decide to manipulate the system to go home after 4 months. We asked him to go home. Thomas W. Wright, U.S. Navy retired, Swiftboat Commander. Far from his commercial portrayal as a purposeful warrior strolling boldly through the jungle, John Carey was regarded by many Swifties as a poor officer. Ted Peck, a Swift Boat commander who operated with Carey in Vietnam, asked Bill Zaldanis, a Carey crewman and supporter, how he could possibly be in favor of Carey. When Zaldanis replied that he wanted a warrior for president, Peck asked, "Yes, but who are you going to get?" Admiral Hoffman characterized Carey as a loose cannon, while Captain Charles Plumley called him devious, requiring constant supervision. For the mere 3 months that Carey was involved in duty in Vietnam, he left behind an amazing legacy of Beetle Bailey bumbling. Steve Gardner is the sole crewman who was not swayed by Carey during his many post-Vietnam years of solicitation, aimed at gaining the support of his crew. Today, Gardner asks, "How can Carey possibly be commander-in-chief when he couldn't competently command a six-man crew?" Gardner, a two-tour Swiftboat sailor who sat 5 feet behind Carey in Vietnam and who saw many officers during his 2 years, judges Carey to be by far the worst Swiftboat commander he saw in Vietnam. Carey was erratic. He hardly ever did what he was supposed to do. His command decisions put us in more peril than he should have, but mostly he just ran. When John Carey looked out the bow of the boat and he saw tracer fire coming after him, he'd turn and run. That isn't what he was supposed to do. His job was to face into the fire, to quarter the boat so we could apply our twin 50-caliber machine guns on the enemy. That was our job in the canal, to stand our ground and suppress the enemy fire. All Carey wanted to do was turn and get out of Dodge at the first sign of trouble. When he should have been fighting, calling in air support, he was hightailing it. That's always been my bone of contention with Carey, his decision-making capabilities. That's what takes him out of contention, as far as I'm concerned. While on patrol in one of the main rivers, for instance, Carey ran his boat out of the water and aground for a number of hours. Not particularly easy to do in the deep river channels. In tour of duty, James Wasser, another Carey crewman and a Carey supporter, recounts one of Carey's mishaps. In addition to leading the board and search operations, it was Wasser's responsibility to stand by his young skipper in the event Lieutenant Carey committed a blunder. Sometimes he got disoriented and misread the navigational maps, Wasser allowed. It was easy to do. Once we hit a sandbar and couldn't get loose. We didn't call in because we didn't want to get John in trouble, We just sat around for hours waiting for high tide. It eventually came, and off we went. This, of course, left Carrie's boat almost defenseless, unable to maneuver, unable to bring guns to bear, unable to withdraw. Aground, Carrie's boat was totally vulnerable to mortar or any other type of attack. Carrie's mistake also left the area that his boat was supposed to be patrolling totally unguarded. Because of the boat's vulnerability and its inability to guard its patrol area and carry out its assignment on station, officers in charge of boats that ran seriously aground were required to report the situation to Coastal Division headquarters immediately. In the above incident, Carrie evidently chose not to call in to avoid getting in trouble. While incidental minor grounding was seldom reported, a serious long-term grounding, like that of PCF 44 described above, would always have been reported, and very little trouble would have ensued, given the nature of the Brown Water Navy. Carrie's decision not to report the episode to his superiors, based on fear of their disfavor, says much about him. In addition to failing to report adverse occurrences, Carrie developed a reputation for simply wandering off aimlessly. For example, on one occasion, after being relieved, he simply diverted his boat into Saigon, now renamed Ho Chi Minh City by the communists, to taste the storied capital, without informing anyone that he had done so or where he was. Carrie asked the tactical operations man if there were any waterway restrictions on traffic to Saigon. Every night on patrol, he gazed longingly upon the bright lights of the big city just 7 miles away, as seductive as the city of Oz or Las Vegas glittering beyond the horizon. Saigon had boutiques, bars, black market deals, nightclubs, brothels, and 56,000 registered prostitutes, plus who knows how many freelancers. There were some river travel restrictions, the officer informed him, but then he confided that there were also a few loopholes, too. On the spot, Carrie decided to exploit those. The key was to have a plausible excuse at the ready should his boat be stopped on its way into the city. We knew that while we were cruising up and down the river at night, someone was sitting at the bar of the Majestic Hotel in the center of the city, drinking, probably with a girl at his side, Carrie explained. It seemed wrong. We were jealous, at any rate, and wanted to share it. So instead of turning right as we left Na Bay after being relieved, we went left, up the Long Taw, and into the heart of the city. We didn't have permission from the division or anyone else, but we felt that we deserved an irresponsible, personal moment, so we did it anyway. Reading Brinkley's account, one wonders why Carrie chose to brag about being irresponsible to the point where he concocted ready-made excuses should he be stopped and questioned, just so he and his crew could share in the sin available in Saigon. Self-reported self-indulgence is hard to comprehend. On March 5th through 7th, 1969, shortly before requesting his transfer from Vietnam, Carrie was under the command of Captain Charles Plumley, U.S. Navy, for an operation in which the Swifts transported mines and personnel near the Bay Hap River. The Swifts were assigned individual positions, where they would wait should mine personnel be attacked or need assistance. Repeatedly, Carrie simply disappeared from position, like a child with an attention problem, according to Captain Plumley. In Plumley's report to Admiral Hoffman, he indicated to Hoffman that he had a terrible problem with Carrie. Carrie simply would not obey orders. As a result, Hoffman came to An Toi and gave a talk to the officers there, not singling Carrie out, indicating that anyone who failed to obey orders in the future would be shipped to Saigon without further notice. That Carrie's stories abound is remarkable, given his short cameo in Vietnam. Many recall Carrie blundering into living quarters in An Toi with a live and dangerous Claymore mine and with B-40s that he had found. He acted like a tourist passing through, as if he intended to keep these items as souvenirs for later political campaigns. Like Lieutenant Kiefer in the Kane Mutiny, the aspiring novelist played by Fred McMurray in the 1954 movie, John Kerry kept busy with his private journal. Kerry also often sported a home movie camera to record his exploits for later viewing. Swifties report that Kerry would revisit ambush locations for reenacting combat scenes where he would portray the hero, catching it all on film. Kerry would take movies of himself walking around in combat gear, sometimes dressed as an infantryman, walking resolutely through the terrain. He even filmed mock interviews of himself narrating his exploits. A joke circulated among Swifties was that Kerry left Vietnam early, not because he received 3 Purple Hearts, but because he had recorded enough film of himself to take home for his planned political campaigns. Kerry's supporters point to an evaluation of Kerry by Commander George Elliott, who rated Kerry one of the few best officers for his 2 months at An Toi. In reality, Elliott gave essentially the same evaluation to every officer at An Toi. Kerry was in the middle of the pack. Elliott felt that all the officers at An Toi deserved superior ratings given the nature of the duty. Most important, Elliott did not know, as some of Kerry's peers had begun to learn, of Kerry's shell game of phony reports, fictitious victories, and concealed groundings. To the contrary, Kerry was ingratiating to superiors, and if judged solely by his own, often phony written reports, a superb warrior, proceeding from triumph to triumph. Commander Elliott notes that the tone and substance of Kerry's reports are captured quite succinctly in Churchill's quote, "I expect history to treat me kindly, since I wrote it." In his after-action reports, Kerry wove a story of often imagined enemy fire, non-existent triumphs, and charges into intense fire against superior numbers of enemy. These accounts existed on paper, but almost never in the real world. Captain Thomas Wright remembers that on multi-boat operations, Kerry would suddenly disappear without warning. He recalls that Kerry's boat had poor fire discipline and would open fire without prior clearance or apparent reason, sometimes opening fire even though the enemy had not fired at him. Because of these problems, Wright requested that Kerry no longer be assigned to operations under his command. Commander Elliott complied, and Wright no longer operated with Kerry. Shortly before Kerry left Vietnam, Wright and others spoke to him at An Toi. Kerry's 3 Purple Hearts would allow him to leave Vietnam, and they urged him to do so. Wright was not upset to see the Boston Strangler leave Vietnam. He believed that Kerry simply did not belong there. Kerry never formed the kind of human relationships with his fellow sailors that are essential to effective performance. Purple Heart Number 2. Kerry claims to have been wounded on February 20, 1969, on the Dam Doi Canal, a canal running north from the Songbo Day River. In other reports, Kerry seems to place the location of the incident on the Kwa Lon to the west. The operating report prepared by Kerry reflects intense rocket and rifle fire. In his biography, Kerry describes blood running down the deck. Just as they moved out onto the Kwa Lon, at a junction known for unfriendliness in the past, kaboom! PCF-94 had taken a rocket-propelled grenade round off the port side, fired at them from the far left bank. Kerry felt a piece of hot shrapnel bore into his left leg. With blood running down the deck, the Swift managed to make an otherwise uneventful exit into the Gulf of Thailand, where they rendezvoused with a Coast Guard cutter. The biography written by the Boston Globe reporters also acknowledges the wound, though the discussion of it is presented in a much less dramatic manner. He was treated on an offshore ship and returned to duty hours later. The officer of the accompanying boat, Rocky Hildreth, states that John Kerry's operating report, which Hildreth did not see until 2004, is false, and that the intense rocket and rifle fire reported by Kerry never happened. It seems very unlikely that Carey's boat could have experienced the heavy fire he reported without the accompanying boat hearing it. Hildreth also reports that there was no blood on the deck, as Carey claimed. Moreover, there was no damage to any boat from the intense rifle and rocket fire reported by Carey. Van O'Dell, a sailor on PCF 93, recounts that when Carey's crew came back that day, he heard them say that Carey had faked a Purple Heart from his own M79 wound. In addition, one of Carey's crewmen, in a 2002 email that he disowned after meeting with Carey, questioned this Purple Heart and indicated that it was for a negligently self-inflicted M79 grenade round, like the one occurring at Comoran Bay. What is beyond question is that Carey suffered at most a minor wound, losing no duty time. His account of blood running down the deck seems exaggerated. An awful lot of blood for a wound requiring what appears to have been minor treatment. If Carey did suffer a minor wound from hostile fire on this occasion, this would have been the only time such a thing happened during his 3 months in Vietnam. In his Dom Doi operating report from February 20, 1969, Carey recommended PSYOPs, psychological operations along the Dom Doi. A recommendation he lauds as a great achievement in his 1970 interview in the Harvard Crimson. One time, Carey was ordered to destroy a Viet Cong village, but disobeyed orders and suggested that the Navy command simply send in a psychological warfare team to befriend the villagers with food, hospital supplies, and better educational facilities. Once again, Carey promotes himself as an anti-war warrior. Surprisingly, the Navy adopted a PSYOPs recommendation. If the idea were indeed Carey's, then it would have been the only such recommendation he made, and the only one to be adopted. At any rate, the program was an unmitigated disaster. Many Swifties, including John O'Neill, wondered who could have been so stupid as to recommend using our boats to travel slowly while playing PSYOPs tapes over a loudspeaker, appealing in Vietnamese to the local population, in an area as hostile as the Dom Doi. Many Swifties and mobile riverine sailors died or were wounded on these missions, following the Boston Strangler's recommendations. One was Shelton White, a well-known film producer of underwater documentaries, who was wounded 3 times on the Dom Doi in a matter of minutes, but who returned to fight again. White and many other sailors who signed the May 4, 2004 Swiftboat Veterans for the Truth letter opposing Carey's presidential campaign did not realize even in 2004 that it was John Carey who had recommended this ill-conceived PSYOPs operation for which they had paid with their blood. Ambush. A couple of days before his second Purple Heart, Carey was also operating with Bob Hildreth, officer in charge of the accompanying boat. It was a day Hildreth would never forget. Carey was the lead boat, with Hildreth behind. There was a small hole in a line of fishing stakes. Carey's boat slipped through first. When Hildreth's boat started through, a mine went off, and then at least 5 rockets were fired at the boat. Standard doctrine and procedure when a boat was under such intense fire was for accompanying boats to stand and fight or return and provide fire support. According to Hildreth, Carey simply fled, providing neither fire support nor even mortar support. Instead, Hildreth and his gallant crew were left alone to fight their way out of the ambush, which Hildreth has never forgotten. I would never want Carey behind me. I wouldn't want him in front of me either, and I sure wouldn't want him commanding our kids in Iraq and Afghanistan. Typically, on Carey's website, as well as in the operating report for that day, which Carey wrote and Hildreth never saw, it is Carey's boat, rather than Hildreth's, that encounters the 5 B-40s and the mine. Carey's flight, leaving Hildreth's boat in serious jeopardy, vanishes from the account, and the event is a real triumph, at least on Carrie's website. The Silver Star. For some 35 years, John Carey has shaped his life around a single moment on February 28, 1969, for which he received the Silver Star. Unlike the lives of the Silver Star winners from Coastal Squadron 1, who signed the May 4, 2004 letter condemning John Carey, or those of the 60 or so holders of one or more Purple Hearts in the same group, Carey's life seems to be frozen at that moment. He has chosen to utilize his 35-year-old Silver Star as the basis for every political campaign he has waged. In each campaign, a new participant in Carey's medal stories is discovered, as was Jim Rassman, the comrade left behind, whom Carey did fish out of the water, but about whom he invented an exaggerated story during the 2004 presidential primary in Iowa. Each Carey campaign ends with Carey embracing his comrades while faulting his opponents for their less meritorious service. Carey's star would never have been awarded had his actions been reviewed through normal channels. In his case, he was awarded the medal 2 days after the incident, with no review. The medal was arranged to boost the morale of Coastal Division 11. But it was based on false and incomplete information provided by Carey himself. Carey did follow normal military conduct and displayed ordinary courage, but the incident was nothing out of the ordinary, and to most Swift and Vietnam veterans, Carey's actions would hardly justify any kind of unusual award. Moreover, to most Swifties, Carey's tactical judgment was very poor, reflecting a willingness to risk boat and crew for medals and personal glory, hardly the type of judgment we expect from a commander-in-chief. The following is the Silver Star citation based on Carey's account. For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity in action while serving with Coastal Division 11, emerged in armed conflict with Viet Cong insurgents in An Duyen Province, Republic of Vietnam, on 28 February 1969. Lieutenant Junior Grade Carey was serving as officer in charge of patrol craft Fast 94 and officer in tactical command of a three-boat mission. As the force approached the target area on the narrow Dong Kung River, all units came under intense automatic weapons and small arms fire from an entrenched enemy force less than 50 feet away. Unhesitatingly, Lieutenant Junior Grade Carey ordered his boat to attack as all units opened fire and beached directly in front of the enemy ambushers. This daring and courageous tactic surprised the enemy and succeeded in routing a score of enemy soldiers. The PCF gunners captured many enemy weapons in the battle that followed. On a request from U.S. Army advisors ashore, Lieutenant Junior Grade Carey ordered PCFs 94 and 23 further upriver to suppress enemy sniper fire. After proceeding approximately 800 yards, the boats were taken again under fire from a heavily foliated area, and B-40 rocket exploded close aboard PCF 94. With utter disregard for his own safety and the enemy